Welcome to One True Podcast. My name is Mark Chirino with Michael Von Cannon producing. In his memoir, A Movable Feast, Ernest Hemingway wrote, "All you have to do is write one true sentence. Write the truest sentence that you know." So finally, I would write one true sentence and then go on from there. In that same spirit of honesty, creativity, and curiosity, One True Podcast explores all things related to Ernest Hemingway, his life, his work, and his world. Our show today explores the legendary Charles Scribner's Sons, Hemingway's professional home for just about all of his literary career, the publishing house of literary titans like Henry James, Theodore Roosevelt, Edith Wharton, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Thomas Wolfe, Hemingway, and so many others. Scribner's gained a reputation for literary quality since its inception in 1846. To guide us through Scribner's From the Inside, we turn to Charles Scribner III, the great-grandson of the original Charles Scribner. Charles Scribner III is an art historian, author, editor, and lecturer based in New York. He specializes in Baroque art, music, and religion. He has written several books on those topics, but he joins us today to discuss his new book, Scribner's Five Generations in Publishing. We are so happy he could join us today. Charles Scribner III, welcome to One True Podcast.
Thank you, Mark. It's a delight to be here, and it's a first-time experience.
Oh,
I've never been on a pod before.
Well, this is a perfect opportunity. We've wanted to have you on for a long time, and we're here really to coincide with this exciting publication of your book, which is called Scribner's Five Generations in Publishing. And of those five generations, of course, it includes Ernest Hemingway as one of its prized authors. Maybe we can just start by talking about the occasion of the book. Why now, and why look back at the history of your family and Scribner's?
The book really was written, I won't say by accident, because I did it deliberately, but it was written in a manic month this last winter in Florida, where my wife insists we retreat to for a couple of months to get away from the cold. And I don't play golf, and I don't play bridge, and I don't drink, so I don't know what else to do down there. So I have to give myself a project. And the year before, I wrote a very short book on religious art and music. I say very short because I had only brought down my iPhone. And if you want to guarantee that your book is short, write it character by character with the index finger on your iPhone.
Did you really?
And I guarantee the book will be short. And that was published just earlier this year, in the spring, in fact, in June, by Roman and Littlefield. And I thought, okay, what's my assignment going to be this year? And I thought, well, I've got these three lovely grandchildren. I really should put down on paper the story of their family and life in books, and tell a lot of the stories, especially about their great-grandfather, my father, that he was too modest to include in his own book which was an oral history converted into a memoir. So it was very selective because, of course, when you're writing an oral history, not writing, but when you're giving an oral history, the book only includes answers to the interviewer's questions.
Right.
So there was a lot in my dad's book, which was a wonderful book published three decades ago, called In the Company of Writers. And I just thought, well, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to write a book about myself, but I'll tell about the earlier generations and a lot of the stuff my dad left out.
Your book emerges not just as a history of the company, a history of your family, but also it walks you essentially through literature over the past 150 years. It is just unbelievable what a role Scribner's has played in that. Maybe we can start all the way at the beginning, because you do take a chronological stroll through your family's history. What do we know about the founder of Scribner's and what motivated him to begin the company?
The company really began, if you will, accidentally or by reason of some form of ill health. We don't know exactly what it was. I say that because originally he started out, he grew up in downtown New York, what's today near Washington Square, the campus, if you will, of NYU, a few blocks away, and his family's house. His father was a New York merchant, and he wanted to be a lawyer. So he went to NYU to study law for a year, and then he switched and went to Princeton and finished up at Princeton. And he was told that because of some frailty of health, that he really wasn't constitutionally equipped to be a lawyer, and that he should choose an easier profession.
And so what year would this have been about?
He graduated from Princeton in 1840, very young. I think he was born in 1821. So they graduated early in those days, but they didn't have long summer vacations. College was very different. And by the time he went abroad, he studied abroad and traveled. And by the time he came back, he got together with a man named Isaac Baker, and in an unused chapel of the family church, which was then called the Brick Meeting House, which is now at the corner, well, was then at the corner of Nassau Street and Park Row opposite City Hall. It is today occupied by the old New York Times building, and it's part of Pace University. There was a church there with an unused chapel, and they set up a little book business to start with reprints and then branch out into the original intent was to branch out as soon as possible and publish original American authors with the emphasis on American, because what a lot of the printing presses, the companies, early publishing companies were doing in those days was publishing reprints of famous British writers. And that it was a wonderful opportunity for them because they didn't have to pay them royalty. There was no international copyright law. So we Americans were just a bunch of
just
pirates.
Pirated, yeah.
Taking the best of English literature and publishing it.
Doesn't your book suggest that there was sort of a theological bent to
very much so.
Now, is that true with all of early American publishing or Scribner's particular?
No, I think that was the first Charles Scribner. I think, you know, to go back to your first question, why I wrote the book, you know, now that you ask about the religious background, I think the seed for this book was planted when I was down in Princeton. It was during COVID. It was very hard to get into the university library where my father had given all the family and publishing archives, all the authors' files, everything, including family papers. And I wanted to see what existed on the founder, the first Charles Scribner, who, as I said, graduated in 1840. And it was a very thin file on him. It had a paper he'd written for Princeton on the problems of Jerusalem, and it was called The Arab. Well, welcome to the 21st century, back in the 1830s. Nothing has changed. And then there was a long letter to his mother about how he had, it was written from Lawrenceville School in the summer. He was then a 15-year-old, and she had obviously saved it and gotten into the family archives. And it went on for pages and pages about how he had really found the comfort of the Christian religion. And he'd been brought up Presbyterian, as all the Scribners were in those days. His grandfather, Matthew Scribner, who graduated from Yale, was a Congregationalist preacher and writer. And so it was in the blood, so to speak, but not in a big way until this 15-year-old boy really got it big time. And I think it stayed with him. And he really wanted to start publishing serious books on Christian religion, which for him meant books of Protestant, Calvinist we would say today, Presbyterian theology. And that was a big movement in the United States in those days. And in fact, the very first book that Scribner's printed, published, its first year of operation, 1846, had the imposing title, The Puritans and Their Principles.
Wow.
And it was by a clergyman in Norwalk, Connecticut, where the family had originally come in 1680 and had lived in, before moving to, his generation moved to New York. There is a Scribner Avenue today in Norwalk, Connecticut. I know, because I was so excited when I saw the sign. I had a friend take an iPhone photo of me climbing the pole.
Are there any copies of that early Puritan and its principle book floating around?
Yes, thank God there are. Thank God for Google and the internet and these online booksellers.
Incredible.
I was curious. I'd never seen it. So I went, this would have been 20 years ago, 2002. I was being given an award by the New England Society, and I thought, well, I should weave into this our first book, The Puritans and Their Principles, which I'd never read, of course, never seen. And because the theme of this book was that the real virtue of Americans was to be found amongst those hard, tough New Englanders of Massachusetts,
sure,
the Puritans, not the easygoing Virginians. Who had bishops. They were Anglicans. They were Church of England. They had the sort of English country life in Virginia. No, these were the hardcore Puritans, and these provided the rocks on which our great country was founded. And I went online and I got a copy. It was the first. Of course, it was the first edition. It was 1846, and I had it, so I was able to read this over the top, flowery passage at the New England Society dinner.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
That was my introduction to our first book. And I was really quite impressed by the scope of it. It was a long book. It's several hundred pages long.
If you had to look back at the origins of Scribner and point to, let's say, was there a title that either sustained the company or launched it? And if so, did that happen during the first owner, the first Scribner?
Oh, definitely.
So
not only
what title would you point to?
Without question. It was within, I don't have, it's in my book. I don't have off the top of my head the exact date, mm-hmm, but it was certainly within the first five or half dozen years of the first few years of the publisher's existence. It was then Baker and Scribner. Well, Baker died a few years later, and then it was just Charles Scribner. And I can tell the book that launched the company, that launched the imprint, that made its first great bestseller, was called Napoleon and His Marshals. And it was by, again, another a Presbyterian clergyman, the Reverend J.T. Headley. And my father, in his memoir, said that by all accounts, it was not historically 100% accurate. But then he said, but then how many bestsellers are? But it was a major bestseller because it was my dad who explained why it was the bestseller to me. He said, in those days, and now we're talking, let's say, in the early 1850s, around 1850. So we're talking a generation after Napoleon's death. There was a huge interest in him in America. And I guess not just because we had the Louisiana Purchase, thanks to him, and we got all those, states west of Georgia, but because he was considered kind of a model of leadership and fascination among businessmen. Apparently, a lot of New York businessmen would have busts of Napoleon in their office, the way there might be a bust of Lincoln in the White House Oval Office. It went through many, many reprintings and was an all-time instant bestseller.
So I'm interested now in the first transition from the founder, first Charles Scribner to Charles Scribner the second. And I guess we're just presuming, looking back, that this was to be a family business that sons would inherit and it would just keep going. But of course, that's not automatic. So what was behind the decision of the son to take over for his father?
The son that took over from the first Charles Scribner was named after his grandfather, who was the railroad tycoon John Insley Blair, mm-hmm. John I. Blair. Anyone from New Jersey might know of Blair Academy, which is quite a famous school. Anyone who's been to Princeton or visited Princeton would know Blair Hall or Blair Tower. I mean, he was a major New Jersey figure, and he, John I. Blair, built more miles of railroad track than anyone in human history. He built and owned more, so he was really the railroad tycoon. His fame is overshadowed by a later railroad tycoon, Commodore Vanderbilt. But it was Blair who actually built more miles of track. He was a very modest and a very philanthropic man. And his grandson, eldest grandson of the first Charles Scribner, his son-in-law, was named John Blair Scribner. And he took over very, very young because his father died at the ripe age of 50 in Switzerland. And he had been working at the firm for a few years, maybe two or three before that. And I wondered, now his mother died 3 years earlier. This would have been 1868. She died right after the birth of her youngest child, a little girl who never knew her. And I wondered why of the three Scribner sons who went to Princeton like their father, why did the eldest not graduate? Mm. And I realized when I looked up, again, thanks to Google and family trees and so on, I looked up births and deaths, I realized his mother died while he was at Princeton. I think he was 20 years old. And he leaving his father with, I think, six young children in the house. And he went, obviously decided his dad needed help in the business. And so he left college and went to work with his dad. And then when his father died, suddenly at the age of 50, 3 years later, he took over. He was, I think at the time he took over, he was 23.
Okay. Still young.
Took over, and he ran the firm for a grand total of 5 years. So if he took over in 1871 when his father died, his younger brother Charles, who was the second Charles, who graduated from Princeton in 1875, he came straight from college graduation into the firm to help his older brother. They worked together for a full 3 years because poor John Blair, he died 3 years later, and he left a widow of Lucy Scribner. She ended up founding Skidmore College.
When we think of Charles Scribner II, that's the figure who was in charge of the company when we're talking about Edith Wharton and F. Scott Fitzgerald, Henry James. Am I correct about that?
Yes.
Okay.
And he had partners who sort of came and went. What happened was he had a partner named Seymour. He had a partner named Armstrong. Armstrong went off to found his own publishing house, which has long since disappeared. Seymour died. And then the third of the sons, Arthur, he graduated from Princeton in 1881. So 10 years after his father died, he was class of 1881, and he came into the firm to help his older brother Charles. So there was the two of them left, And they decided it to honor their father by renaming the firm Charles Scribner Sons. And at that point, with Charles, the second Charles and Arthur, it became an all-family firm. There were no outside partners.
I see.
And that's how it was for the next, well, more than 100 years.
One clarification about the partners, these partnerships. Were these financial partnerships or were there editorial? Did they share editorial decisions?
I think they were mostly financial partnerships.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the editorial decisions were with Scribner. Now, the first Charles Scribner, he just before he died, he started a very successful magazine.
That's what I was going to ask you about, yeah.
Scribner's Monthly. And in 1871, it came out, the first issue of the year he died. And 100 years later, my father republished in one volume the whole first year. It's a big, fat volume, and that's still available, the first year of Scribner's Monthly. And that was an enormous success.
So Scribner's, the magazine, was important to the company both financially, but it also gave a kind of prestige to writers. Is that, do you see it as benefiting in more than just one way?
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. It would be as though you, a publishing house owned the New Yorker, and it was a great net for catching new talent before they wrote their books. So many of the authors. Well, for example, I started with Scribner's Monthly. That's a complicated story because the second Charles, who presided over it, loved it and built it up. One of the famous books that came out of it was a series of articles about Stanley finding Dr. Yep. Livingstone in Africa. And that became a bestseller called In Darkest Africa. Finding Livingstone. But then he followed that with a book about Africa. But that had outside partners. And the balance of power was financially was shifting to, it was set up as a separate company, Scribner and Company, to publish the magazine. And my great-grandfather, the second Charles, he sold it. And the magazine company then decided, their owners decided, and he was a minority owner, that they might even start publishing books. And my great-grandfather, or Charles II, he was not about to be a minority to anybody. And so he sold it, and it became known as the Century Magazine. It was bought by the Century Company, and it had its own second life. And one of the terms of the sale was that Scribner's, Charles Scribner's sons, the Scribner family, could not go back into the magazine business for 5 years. And as proof of just how much my great-grandfather thought of literary magazines and popular magazines, because they had nonfiction stories in them. They had a lot of the great illustrators were launched in the magazine. Maxfield Parrish, N.C. Wyeth, Howard Pyle, etc. But when the clock struck 12, so to speak, in 1887, 5 years after the magazine was sold, January of 1887, first issue of a new magazine called Scribner's Magazine, and the cover was designed by the great Beaux-Arts architect Stanford White.
This episode of One True Podcast is supported by the Hemingway Review, the scholarly journal of the Ernest Hemingway Foundation and Society. Michael and I are huge fans of the Hemingway Review. We always read it to see the latest scholarship. You can buy back issues of the Hemingway Review at hemingwaysociety.org/journals. Charles, you mentioned that you equated this to sort of owning the New Yorker, but you'd have to imagine that the reading public would have treated a literary magazine differently in the late 19th century and even the early parts of the 20th century than we do in the 21st century. The New Yorker is something that, intellectuals would read and those sort of the literati, but would Scribner's magazine have had a wider reach?
Oh, much, much, much wider. And actually, I use the New Yorker as an example for how a magazine could be a net for literary talent for a publisher. It's a bad analogy. It's a very poor analogy for what Scribner's magazine was. Scribner's magazine was much closer. I don't know if you're probably too young to remember Life magazine.
Mm-hmm, sure.
But or think Life. Think of sort of. Or a Time magazine. It was a monthly, so it wouldn't be like Time.
But like Life magazine, you know, The Old Man and the Sea was published in Life magazine as a complete document.
Yes, Scribner's magazine was really meant to be a widely popular magazine with top subjects on everything.
Yeah.
It was not literary in quotes. It had writers. It had fiction writers. It had nonfiction writers. But it was really meant to be what later television was.
Right.
I mean, it was meant to be popular entertainment. And it was hugely popular in its day until it was overtaken in the 20th century by the slicker magazines, New York Post, Look, Life, etc., which had a wider reach.
One of the strains to your book is that whatever Scribner is in charge, whatever era it is, there's always a literary advisor or an editorial team. And so I wonder about, let's start with, we're talking about Charles II, who had all of these incredible talents, the who's who of early 20th century American literature. Would you say that Charles Scribner II had an eye for emerging talent, or did he have a wonderful team? How did he operate?
To be absolutely candid, and I don't think I was quite so candid in the book, my father speculated that his grandfather loved being a publisher, a book publisher. And he had the books on his shelves. He wasn't sure how many of those books his grandfather actually had read. He loved the business of publishing. He loved publishing authors of great worth. From Robert Louis Stevenson was one of his giant authors. Rudyard Kipling, Henry James. Edith Wharton, who first debuted in the magazine in a story. So there's an example of how useful the magazine was. It got us Edith Wharton.
Yeah.
That's not a bad catch.
No, not at all.
But no, he had a very good team, and he had a literary advisor about whom I know less than I should. Because he was a giant in his age.
Fitzgerald and Hemingway also are part of the transition between Charles Scribner II and Charles Scribner III.
Absolutely. So, and actually, the second, in addition, I mean, he built the buildings. He built the beautiful Beaux-Arts.
Okay.
Location down, it's still there on 20th Street and Fifth Avenue.
With the huge painted wall, right? The huge emblem on the brick.
No, that's the second.
Oh, I
see. It's much larger. That's the building my grandfather, my dad, and I, the three of us, worked in. That was built in 1930. The one downtown was built in 1895. Let us say in the heyday of the golden age of Scribner's Magazine. The downtown was the age of Henry James, Robert Louis Stevenson, Edith Wharton. Then we move uptown in 1913, the year my grandfather graduates from Princeton and joins the firm. And that's the building everyone knows today.
Right.
That's now had a famous bookstore in it. That's now occupied by Club Monica, a company owned by Ralph Lauren. So, we've gone from books to Ralph Lauren, but anyway, the Charles II, without question, if you're looking at the 20th century, now he's an older man by then. He's getting into he dies in 19 30, I think. And so he's already middle-aged, and his greatest achievement, I guess, as a CEO, would in hindsight be the hiring of a young Harvard, well, actually two Harvard graduates, class of 1910, 3 years older than my grandfather, Maxwell Perkins, who came to join the advertising department in 1910, and an even more literary editor than Max Perkins, literary in the sense that he was also a great poet and really had he was more of a literary highbrow, a wonderful editor named John Hall Wheelock, who was also a poet. And they came out of Harvard, and they were at Harvard with T.S. Eliot. I mean, this wasn't a bad time to go to Harvard. But Perkins, soon after, became, my grandfather joins just in time to go to the new building in 1913. Perkins, either that year or the next year, the very next year, but soon thereafter, was converted from the advertising department to an editor. And that is the beginning of a new era, the Perkins era. Hemingway, Fitzgerald, Thomas Wolfe.
We had A. Scott Berg on One True Podcast, and one of the things that emerged with Maxwell Perkins is when he gets a manuscript like This Side of Paradise in 1919, you know, and he's rejecting it, and then he's urging Fitzgerald to rewrite it. There's something generational about it, so that Charles Scribner II would have had to either trust Perkins that he had the sensibility or the taste, maybe the eye for what the next generation of American literature would look like. Is that your understanding of how that dynamic worked?
Yes. To be fair to Perkins and his ability to be long-suffering and not to give up on this budding writer in whom he had great confidence, Scott Fitzgerald, my great-grandfather turned down the proposed novel, which was published as This Side of Paradise. It was then called The Romantic Egoist, or The Romantic Egotist, right, with a T. He turned it down twice and said no. It's not. So I guess he did read. And Perkins kept working with Fitzgerald, and Fitzgerald kept revising. And finally, it was after many revisions, it was published as This Side of Paradise and was a huge success. So my grandfather did not give Perkins carte blanche, but he did have enormous faith in him.
And then Perkins stayed with the company until the end.
Well, Perkins arrived in 1910, as I said, became an editor in 14, and died very young, died in 1947. Yum. But he presided over enormous, enormous talent.
One of the things that you reveal in your book is, so we have Fitzgerald has a career with Scribner's where he doesn't even maintain the early success of the early 20s, even through The Great Gatsby. But you mention that Scotty and you had a particular relationship or a friendship that lasted throughout her life. Is that right?
Oh, I was enormously fond of her, and really all thanks to my father, who sort of put us together. They were exact contemporaries. So Scotty worked closely with my father, because remember, she was a college student when her father died, and the books weren't selling.
Yeah, I know that dealing with the estates of certain authors might not always be harmonious, but Scribner's and the Fitzgerald estate have always seen eye to eye about how those books are sold and so forth.
Yes, I think that's fair to say, and certainly also I would say the same of the Hemingway estate, because our goals were in sync. I mean, my father, one of the things he did when he took over at the ripe age of 30, his father died at the ripe age of 62. And Dad, I was in Washington a baby. And my dad was down there because he'd been called up as a Naval Reserve cryptanalyst to break enemy codes during the Korean War. He'd been called back into service. They let him out to take over the publishing company in 1952 when his father died. A few months later, they finally let him out. He was commuting one day a week from Washington to New York to preside over the company in the first year. But one of the things he did was to take back the reprint licenses to the mass market paperback companies like Bantam, Dell, etc. All our great novels were being sold by other publishers in cheap paperbacks. They weren't being sold by Scribners. And he took them back and put them into hardcover and originally, and even took back the licenses from the Modern Library. And Hemingway was upset by that because he liked the prestige of being included in the Modern Library. But my father said, look, my objective for you is to make as much money for you and your family as I can. That's my job. And I'm going to make higher royalties for you directly from Scribners than you will earn as a piece of all these licenses.
Your father enters in 1952, as you say, which is such a particular period of Hemingway's life. So he's just published Across the River and Into the Trees. The Old Man and the Sea is coming out. He's such an established author. The Nobel Prize is coming in a couple of years. And I think I can say that your characterization of the relationship between Hemingway and your father is a little bit on eggshells, walking on tiptoes around Hemingway. Is that fair to say?
That is more than fair to say. He described it at the end of his chapter on Hemingway. In his oral biography in the Company of Writers, he said being Hemingway's publisher was like being strapped into the electric chair, all the electrodes in place, never knowing when or whether the switch would be flipped.
Is it because he was volatile or demanding?
Hemingway had an enormous temper. But on the other hand, Hemingway called my grandfather, who was just, well, 6 years older. So they were contemporaries. He referred to my grandfather as his best friend. And my grandfather was the only one who could make suggestions for changes in Hemingway's books that he would take. And I say that because Perkins was, of course, famous as being the editor of Fitzgerald, Hemingway, and Wolfe. But Perkins never really edited Hemingway. Hemingway wouldn't have allowed anybody to make changes. He would make some changes, word changes, from my grandfather because he considered my grandfather first and foremost a sportsman. He considered him a publisher as I consider myself, by accident of birth. And in his introduction to the post-war edition of A Farewell to Arms, the illustrated edition that my father had to oversee in 1946, right after the war. In his introduction, he refers to my grandfather as a man who knows a great deal about horses, something about running a publishing company and enough about books or something. It was very dismissive and funny, but it made the point that he saw him first and foremost as a great sportsman. He was a great equestrian. And so, and he's probably the only graduate of Princeton to list in the senior book as his favorite sport, fox hunting. So that's how Hemingway saw him. And because Hemingway saw him as a country gentleman and a sportsman, he didn't feel threatened. He never felt that if my grandfather made a suggestion, it was as a literary person or as somehow being in competition with him in that field of his life. And so he was willing to listen. And he made several changes in Across the River and Into the Trees that my father said would go to his grave with him. He told me what they were, but I pulled the curtain at this point. But he did make some there were some offensive.
No One True Podcast exclusive, Charles? You're not going to give us an exclusive here?
I'll tell you one, but not the most offensive. I think he used an expression for something that was so old it went back to when Christ was a corporal.
Yikes!
But I think that offended my grandfather's religious sensibilities. But there were
worse,
some
yeah.
really offensive. There were offensive depictions of the character whom my grandfather was very fond of and also published, Hemingway's third wife, Martha
yes,
Gellhorn.
Yes, that's true.
And Hemingway took some real shots at her in Across the River and Into the Trees. And that was the only friction they ever had was over Martha Gellhorn. Hemingway wanted Martha's novel published as Martha Hemingway. She, being an independent and talented writer in her own right, she wanted it to be published as Martha Gellhorn. And my grandfather let her have her way. And I think that irked Hemingway, but he forgave him.
One more question about your father's relationship with Hemingway. Was his concern with maintaining a good relationship with Hemingway, A, financial, because Hemingway was such an important author to the business, or was it part of the burden of Hemingway having been his father's friend also, and his father, they had a publishing relationship already, so he sort of wanted to stay true to that and maintain that. Where did the pressure come from?
Well, I think it was those two things. Of course, Hemingway was a big name, and he wanted to maximize the sales of the books and the profits for Hemingway and his children. So there was that financial aspect to it. He accomplished that by publishing the books directly and giving. Hemingway got the highest royalty of any Scribner author. And Hemingway had such confidence in himself and such pride, he never took an advance on a book. He would occasionally ask Scribners for what he called a loan, an interest-free loan on future sales, which he always paid back. But he would not take an advance. Instead, and after Hemingway died, his attorney, Alfred Rice, always, his policy was Hemingway gets a higher royalty than any other Scribner author. So that answers only part of your question. I think the friendship, yes, and also the fact that my father thought that this was such a literary giant that even if his books hadn't been wildly successful at that period, there was a moral and literary obligation to keep to do the best by him because he was so important a figure in American literature. And the third part was very personal. Hemingway had written my father when his father died very suddenly, the most beautiful condolence letter I have ever read in my life. And I read it aloud on the A&E biography of Hemingway that's on YouTube that was 25 years ago. And it's a beautiful letter. And one of the things he says in it, he says, "You never, never have to worry about me, Charlie. In other words, Hemingway was 110% loyal to his one and only publisher. And my father felt that kind of loyalty you do not take lightly.
Charles, could you read that letter to your father from Hemingway? I thought it was such a magnificent part of your book.
You see, my grandfather died very suddenly of a heart attack at age 62. And Hemingway had called him his best friend. And to my grandmother, he wrote a lovely condolence letter. He said to her, "Now my dear and good friend is gone. And there is no one to confide in, nor trust, nor make rough jokes with. And I feel so terribly about Charlie being gone that I can't write anymore." And then a week later, he mailed an equally heartfelt letter to my father, which I think is one of the most beautiful condolence letters ever written. Dad was still on active duty as a Navy lieutenant in breaking enemy codes in Washington during the Korean War. And Hemingway wrote this to him. He said, "I won't try to write to you how much he meant to me as a friend and as a publisher. He was the best and closest friend that I had, and it seems impossible that I will never have another letter from him. It does not do any good to talk about it, and there is nothing to say that makes it any easier. Since he had to die, at least he has gotten it over with. If there is anything practical I can do, please let me know. I will try and not worry you about finances nor about anything else. You don't have to write me letters nor have me on your mind in any way. I know what a terribly tough job you have now with Navy, estate, and the House of Scribner to look after. They shouldn't do that to any human being. Please take it as easy as you can, and feel free to call on me in any way that I can be of help. This is not a good letter, Charlie, but I still feel too sad to write a good one. Your friend, Ernest Hemingway." And then, with typical Papa precision, he added this postscript, quote, "Am sorry I don't know your rank, so address this as a civilian, E.H."
That is such a magnificent letter. Charles, one of the things that I observe is what you were saying, that he wrote to your grandmother about rough jokes. And whenever I read Hemingway's letters, he seemed to use the letters that he wrote to the whichever Scribner he was writing to as an opportunity really to let off steam. And he could write some of the most vituperative, you know, things that you wish you wouldn't press send. He would do that to your father and grandfather.
Absolutely. Well, more to my grandfather. Mm-hmm. It's unfortunate in one way. Well, it's equally unfortunate for our generation and the younger generation today with text messages and emails, because they often, with their friends, do the same thing. And to the outside world, we read only what's on the page. We only read the words. We don't hear the tone of voice or know the relationship behind those words. And know when this, let's say it's an athlete in the locker room, they may be blasting things in the locker room that they would never say publicly as representative of their true feelings. They're just letting, as you say, letting off steam. These words are not to be taken seriously. And my grandfather, in turn, would try to entertain Hemingway by writing back equally outrageous jokes to him. But this was all what Hemingway used to call joking rough.
Yeah.
And these were jokes. But the problem is, jokes, you do not joke in print.
And a lot of Hemingway's jokes haven't aged well or his comments haven't aged well as we look back at them 100 years later, 80 years later. He had such a volcanic wrath about certain things. And he would write to your grandfather, let's say, and just let it all out on the page and then say, "Oh, well, now I'm done," or "now I can go about my business."
I was very upset because the only letter that was quoted to my grandfather, and they had a huge correspondence back and forth, was a disgusting letter that Hemingway wrote about our best-selling author, James Jones.
Oh, yes, that's right.
And he just, the imagery of the letter castigating Jones and from here to eternity is just so gross that that letter should have been destroyed. But unfortunately, now it's considered a relic.
So I wanted to move a little bit closer to the present and about your own involvement with Scribner's. And I guess the same question that I asked about Charles Scribner II, which is, was this predestined for you? What was your, how natural was your evolution into running Scribner's?
Well, I never ran it, to be fair. My father was the last chairman, CEO of the company. He was the last head, because during the time I was there with him in 1984, we decided to merge the company into a larger publishing company,
yes,
Macmillan. And that was a very happy merger. That was not an acquisition. We didn't put the company up for sale. It was an arranged marriage, if you will. So I never ran the company. And actually, I went to work there as an editor between graduate degrees in art history, between my master's and my PhD. And I really did it as a sort of thought was going to be a temporary job, as I got to thinking about writing my dissertation. And I just stayed on. And I ended up writing the dissertation in the office 2 hours every morning before the mail came in.
Was the decision to merge difficult? Did it have the weight of 150 years behind it, or did it seem like a logical progression?
Well, at the time, and by the 80s, it was easily a logical progression. It had been made easier by the fact that we made a smaller merger a few years earlier. In 1978, we merged with a very fine small publishing house called Athenaeum, headed by the son of the great Alfred Knopf, Pat Knopf. And my father was a great fan of Pat Knopf's and thought that this would solve the problem of scale. And it was really overseen by our then president and chief operating officer, the man who knew a great deal about books and loves books to this day, a man named Franklin Lee Rogers, who was my father's right hand. And he really was running the company, the business side of it. And he was the one who was the point man of that merger. And it, in theory, was a good idea, but the problem was, Scribner's had this problem a century earlier, in my great-grandfather's day. My father gained a partner, a minority partner who wanted to wag the dog. And it turned out to be a less than happy, blissful marriage. And that, in my mind, made it much easier to then say, okay, well, since we're no longer 100% family anymore anyway, why don't we join an even larger family and become part of a household we really want to thrive in? And it's worked out to this day. It was absolutely no regrets whatsoever.
One of the striking aspects of your book comes later in the narrative, and this is as you're trying to assess your own role in the Scribner's company, and you write, "I felt torn. Should I stay on or move on?" And then a conversation with Phyllis James. So then you write, "I had, after all, become a publisher and editor by accident of birth, and those family ties had now loosened. I would remain ambivalent for several years to come, but in the meantime, I decided to pursue art history on a parallel track outside my day job." And was that, so when you say I felt torn, that was a difficult decision.
Yes, it was, because I really felt that my job had been done. We were now apart. My father had retired. Phyllis, who was our dearest and closest friend as an author, we launched her with her first 9 books. She'd gone over to Knopf to be published after the Macmillan merger. Because she felt, since it was no longer a family company, my father had retirement coming up, that she didn't. I remember she wrote my father a lovely letter of congratulations on the merger. She said, "But I do not necessarily consider myself chattel." So that was a sign.
Yes.
That, and I think her agent was all too eager to auction her off to the highest bidder. Yes, I was torn. But, you know, what's that old expression? Be careful what you pray for, you may get it. In my case, the couple of times I prayed for something else, first it was to be an art professor at Princeton. The senior faculty wanted me, but the junior faculty didn't want competition with that had an inside track. And I did have an inside track. So I didn't get that. Jacques Barzin, who was then the greatest literary advisor, I think, in our company's history, after he was provost of Columbia, my dad took him on for 2 days a week. He did everything. He advised on everything from P.D. James's Mysteries to the slew of reference works that were being published. He told me after I didn't get the job at Princeton, he said, "Charlie, you're much better off staying here at Scribner's. You'll have a much nicer life." And I said, "Why do you say that?" And he said, "Well, academic politics are particularly nasty." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because the stakes are so small."
Charles Scribner III, the book is Scribner's Five Generations in Publishing. Charles, there was so much we didn't touch on. I would love to do this again and get even more granular about your fascinating history. Thanks so much for joining us on One True Podcast.
Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure to revisit all those happy moments with you.
And thanks to you all for listening in. This episode and past episodes are available on onetruepod.com or wherever you get your podcasts. For more Hemingway talk, we invite you to join our One True Book Club on Patreon, where we are reading A Farewell to Arms chapter by chapter. Just visit patreon.com/onetruepodcast and pay as little as $2 a month for all our content. Our book, One True Sentence, Writers and Readers on Hemingway's Art, is available anywhere books are sold. So if you have someone in your life who loves books and Hemingway, One True Sentence makes a wonderful gift. This show is supported by the Hemingway Society and Florida Gulf Coast University. Join us next time as we continue exploring Hemingway, his life, his work, and his world. Until then, I'm Mark Chirino with Michael Von Cannon, and this is One True Podcast.